And consumption of audiovisual media. The development of cheap digital cameras and mobile phones has brought the production of film and video within the reach of everyone, of an unprecedented amount of people, everyone who can afford such a phone and has internet access. Because the internet provides the distribution platforms for this do-it-yourself culture of audiovisual media production, via platforms such as YouTube, as we've seen, and Vimeo. And mobile media screens bring the digital moving image within the reach of everyone with a connection anywhere, anytime. And as Rick Prelinger, one of the founding board members of the Internet Archive, has pointed out, the ubiquity of audiovisual content in a digital age yields expectations of the traditional guardians of audiovisual heritage, such as film archives, broadcasting archives, and media art institutes. Audiences today expect unlimited access anytime, with the ability to actively engage with the content in the form of downloading, remixing, adding comments and content of their own. So in the past decades, many audiovisual archives have undertaken efforts to digitize part of their legacy collections, as well as design new strategies for collecting and preserving born digital material for long-term access and reuse. And I had to think, when I listened to Michael Krone this morning, I had to think of Richard Wright, the former head of the BBC archives, who in Mexico, where I attended a conference on this topic, boldly showed a graph of what he thought would happen to the analog heritage collections. They would completely disappear in terms of importance. So for him, he's very provocative. He says, the future is 120%. In the direction of digital. Well, of course, it was a provocative statement, but he really gave us something to think about. Okay. In this lecture, I investigate the impact of digitization on audiovisual archiving. I will discuss a number of examples from the field of archiving film, broadcasting materials, and media art, to argue, as Valeska already said, that digitization affects audiovisual archiving on three levels. First, it affects the materiality of the object. And examples from the field of film archiving and media art will demonstrate how digitization faces curators and conservators with an object that has changed in appearance and behavior. Second, digitization affects archival practice, because in order to preserve the interactive, process-based and versatile nature of digital audiovisual productions, archivists and conservators need to be much more proactive than before, taking decisions about selection, description and preservation at the moment of production, rather than after distribution. Moreover, the specific nature of digital media necessitates a rethinking of fundamental archival concepts such as authenticity and provenance. I will propose one way of rethinking authenticity for media art with reference to the field of theatrical performance. Third, digitized and born digital content invites new forms of reuse. In order to remain relevant in a connected digital world, archives need to embrace participation by their audiences as a standard element of all aspects of the archival process, if alone to remain relevant in a digital future. In the past decade, as I said, many audiovisual archives have invested a lot of money and efforts in digitizing parts of their collections. And this affects their materiality. Because analog objects are characterized by a physical analogy between the shape of the source and that of the resulting representation, as in the case of the brush strokes on a painting that are the result of the brush held by the maker. And with digitization, analog objects are converted into binary code, making them available for computer-based storage, retrieval, and manipulation. And there, the direct link with the shape of the source is broken. In the field of art, digitization is generally employed to generate digital reproductions of existing objects or other instances of artistic production with the purpose of extending their public dissemination. As Walter Benjamin has famously argued, the circulation of copies of artwork significantly changes their meaning, in that mechanical reproduction severs the bond between the image and the unique context and hand of its maker, and thus depriving the work of its aura. Yet in the case of the traditional arts of painting, drawing, and sculpture, the creation of a digital reproduction does not necessarily make the authentic work disappear. In fact, the wide availability of reproductions also entails a renewed desire for experiencing the aura of the original in publicly accessible exhibitions. In the case of newer media, however, in particular those of photography and film, the transition from analog to digital does influence the appearance and experience of the original work to an extent that gives rise to fundamental debates about the impact of digitization on the aesthetics of analog media. And this is particularly so now that the role of digital technology has increasingly permeated all aspects of film production, distribution, preservation, and exhibition. The majority of cinema viewers by now, or very soon, will only see films as digital projections. And even in film archives, which rely on the developments in industry, it will become increasingly difficult to sustain an entire analog workflow. And digitization fundamentally changes the material base of film. As I said, analog media literally store and preserve traces of people, objects, or events. And in the case of film, those are sculpted in the chemical substrate of the celluloid base by light rays reflecting from them. In this sense, they have an indexical relation to reality, a direct physical connection between the object and its representation. Digital media, on the other hand, host and compute symbols for numbers, which are divorced from any physical unit and have to be translated by interface computers to regain a human perceivable form. So there, this direct physical link with reality is broken. And for many artists, critics, and archivists, the disappearance of the analog film strip signals the end of cinema as a distinct art form. For example, the British critic Dave Vaughan wrote an essay tellingly titled "From Today, Cinema is Dead." And in her 2011 Turbine Hall commission at Tate, entitled Film, Tessita Dean celebrated the film strip by making it visibly present in her homage to the analog film. The debate specifically focused on film's indexical relation to reality. Digital images would break the link with reality depicted, be open to manipulation, and thus compromise the truth value associated with cinema's photographic base. And Vaughan clearly expresses what is at stake when film's indexicality is broken. And I quote, "The analog has been the mode for human consciousness ever since we first carved a reindeer on a piece of antler. We are now, within a mere couple of decades, casting it all away. This may mean the end of us." Yet in my view, these critics overstate the point. It's true that analog and digital media are fundamentally different. Yet it is not true that in digital form, film is no longer film. And this is because analog film is not devoid of manipulation itself. From the start of the medium, it has equally been manipulated. Second, it's also not true that digital media cannot have an indexical relation to reality. For as film scholar Tom Gunning has pointed out, an index need not necessarily resemble the thing it represents. Think, for instance, of other instruments for measuring temperature, for instance, or and the fact that digital photographs can still serve on passports as evidence of someone's identity. Third, film is also much more than its material base. It's also defined by editing, illusion, the subjective effects of the cinematographic apparatus, photography's excessive detail, uniqueness, and contingency. And these are all elements that can be continued in digital form. In short, it does, on a fundamental level, it does not necessarily mean that archives are dealing with a completely different object. In order to show how this works out in practice, I will briefly discuss a specific case, the Dutch artist Marijke van Warmerdam, who in 2012 took the decision to digitize most of her 16mm film installations. Van Warmerdam is best known for her film-based installations, which present simple settings or movements, such as a girl performing a handstand, in short film loops that are projected in the gallery space. On the occasion of her monographic exhibition held at the Boijmans van Beuningen Museum in Rotterdam in 2011, Van Warmerdam's film-based works were digitized by the iFilm Institute Netherlands, our national film museum. In the exhibition, they were for the first time shown as digital projections. And from a conservation point of view, this is remarkable, since Van Warmerdam highly values the sculptural character of her installations and the disappearance of the 16mm film projectors and their characteristic sound significantly changed the appearance of the works. However, I would argue that in most of her film installations, Van Warmerdam is primarily interested in the reality effect of photography-based media that Gunning has argued can be maintained in digital projection. Thematically, her work is very much about letting us see reality or aspects of reality from a very different perspective. And film, with its abundance of details and its focus on capturing a unique, fleeting moment, is very suited to focus our attention on that. So for most of her works, the digital version is not ontologically different from the analog original. Yet this is different for some of her works, where the sculptural quality that she finds so important would be severely compromised if projected digitally. An example is Circle from 1992, filmed at a square in Marrakech, Morocco, where the rotation of the projector mimics that of the camera that recorded the footage, and thus this setup documents the original setting of the analog recording, and simply doesn't seem to make sense to put a digital projector on a rotating platform. Other examples are works like Rice and Passage, that in their projection setup evoke an intimacy that would be severely compromised when done with a digital projector. It is also different for works that explicitly thematize photographies and films' indexical material qualities, such as the works of Tacita Dean and James Coleman, or filmmakers like Peter Kubelka and Peter Tchaikovsky. In sum, digitization does change the materiality of the archival medium, but from an ontological perspective, the essence of the medium can be maintained in digitization. And in the end, it depends on the specific nature of the works at hand, whether the digitization would severely compromise the work's nature. If not always affecting the archival object in an ontological sense, digitization does lead to fragmentation of the object. because digitally produced films, broadcasting materials, and media artworks exist in multiple versions that may also change over time. That brings me to part two of my talk on how digitization affects archival practice. In digital form, audiovisual media exists in multiple versions, are seen on different platforms, are interactive, process-based, and change over time. Consequently, archivists and conservators need to be much more proactive than before, taking decisions about selection, description, and preservation at the moment of production, rather than after distribution. For example, in broadcasting archives, we see that we see in the National Broadcasting Archive in the Netherlands that the archives moves into the digital production environment to make decisions about which of the files and which of the versions should become heritage materials. And so we see that news production has become completely multifaceted, and so is its distribution. And film production has become equally fragmented, also necessitating a proactive attitude towards the selection of archivable content. And museum conservators involved in production and acquisition of works, as with Carlos Garaycoa's letters to the censors at Tate, their curators, conservators, technicians worked together with the artists when the work was created to solve some practical problems like elements of the work overheating. So it's a work that shows excerpts of films that were censored by the Cuban government. But as you can see, it's a very tiny projection, so it was a technically complex work. As well as the fact that the images are tiny causes visitors to walk up closely, and that is also a risk of damage. So you see how such a work becomes a collaborative effort between the technicians and curators and the artist himself. And when such works are acquired, you also need to be much more proactive. So this is a model developed for the project Matters in Media Art by Tate, where you see that the conservator has moved forward. So it's not that the museum buys a work and then it is displayed and then the conservator comes after, but you see that the verifications of the components of the artwork has moved into the accessioning phase. And very often, conservators are also consulted in the pre-acquisition phase to determine, for instance, the costs of maintaining a work, multimedia work or time-based artwork with multimedia components over the long term. So the decision to acquire is also based on insights into what it will cost, literally, in time and energy to save the work. It also causes exhibition dilemmas. How to collect and display works that refer to the individual use of personal computers at home and transfer them to a gallery room designed for different, more static objects. The art collective, Net Art Collective Jodi, have developed installations based on their manipulations of desktop interfaces, such as this work, My Desktop, a piece that displays Mac OS 9 computers running amok, and that was developed as a four-screen installation. But what to do with works that were designed for individual browsing, such as Jodi's own website, jodi.org, the iconic work which initiated their popularity in the contemporary art world? How do you present such a work in a museum context? So it was born online, it lived online, it relies, so what you see is a bunch of scrambled code, and when you click on it, you get this layout of a this drawing of an atomic bomb. So that's a joke that they built in. But of course it's meant for people that should click on it in its entire form and setup. It's made for a home computer browsing and clicking. So how do you translate that to, if you'd want to do a theme, a monographic exhibition in a museum, how to exhibit this? So these examples underline the variable nature of digitized and born digital heritage. It can appear in multiple versions that change over time. They are produced, circulated, and perceived in a complex network. This is a network that comprises multiple actors, both humans but also non-human actors, technological ones, algorithms, the metadata that are automatically added to content by recording equipment, etc. They are interactive in that their form and appearance is partly determined by the way they are used. And I, in this sense, we are also moving from the audiovisual archiving field closer to the traditional paper archiving field, which where a colleague of mine from archival studies recently explained that if you now need this document from the municipality stating who you are, so this document that you need when you apply for a job or something, I don't know the exact term, that this document doesn't really exist. What exists are data about you in different data sets, and then at the moment this document is created, these data are pulled together, and only at the moment of printing the document as such exists as an object. Otherwise, it's just data in databases, plus metadata that say which data belong together. So latent objects. And these objects or records are processual. They change over time and with the input of each user. Consequently, the specific nature of digital media necessitates a rethinking of fundamental archival concepts such as authenticity and provenance. How to archive a process? Where should we locate authenticity? In order to answer these questions, I will now again focus on the field of media art, where many scholars and conservators have tried to reconceptualize conservation theory and practice. This is particularly so because the variable nature of media artworks fundamentally challenges the concept of authenticity underlying traditional conservation practice. Because of technical obsolescence and the interactive process-based nature of many of these works, they change in technique and appearance. And conservators do not like that, of course. They are trained to avoid change, to hold the influence of time. Yet in the case of these works, change is inevitable, meaning that the way we think about change and authenticity has to be rethought, because the works behave differently, so I think we need to change the practice and the underlying ideas on the practice rather than try to put these variable media in a straitjacket and so that they fit our traditional practices. I will now add one such possible new approach to their conservation. For the conservation of time-based media artworks, inspiration has been sought in the field of the performing arts, where works exist as scripts or scores and manifest themselves in various live performances. And this analogy is useful because it allows one to distinguish between the concept of a work, its core, its essence, and its various manifestation at each new exhibition, so the part that is changing and variable. A well-known example is Richard Reinhardt's, who developed a media art notation system on the basis of an analogy with music. Another example is Pip Lorentzen, who's head of collection care research at Tate, who in this seminal essay out of 2006 used Nelson Goodman's distinction between allographic and autographic works of art, so autographic works of art bearing the signature of their maker, like paintings, and allographic ones, which do not require the hand of the maker to be an original work, like in musical scores. And she used this distinction to locate authenticity in the idea or score or script of a work, rather than in its material manifestation. In researching the digitization of Van Warmerdam's film installations, I explored the analogy with theatrical performance for rethinking authenticity in media art, and in particular the notion of dramaturgy. This is a useful concept because it allows us to embrace change as something positive that gets us out of the freeze frame paradigm of traditional conservation. Second, it offers us a perspective on documentation that shares the responsibility among all different stakeholders, extending the ecosystem of time-based media conservation beyond the museum's walls. Contemporary approaches to dramaturgy define the concept as referring to a play's or performance's composition or structure, the constellation of elements that give a play its appearance and meaning. Besides, the term is also conceived as a process, an activity that concerns an engagement with the work's composition, and that extends between the specific role of the dramaturg. As in musicology, dramaturgy as defined in performance studies distinguishes between the composition of a play as script and the composition of the play as performed. Theatre scholars Kathy Turner and Sin Bernd stated as follows: in analysing performance, we cannot assume that the script exists in causal relationship to the event, so to its actual performance in a play. Consequently, dramaturgy is tied to two different temporalities. The dramaturgy of the play text remains more or less the same and transcends space and time, whereas the dramaturgy of a play in performance is a unique live event that is always situated in a specific time and place. So this approach or conceptualization allows for different versions of the same artwork. In addition, the notion of dramaturgy acknowledges that the production of complex artworks and performances and their performances are collaborative activities in which the acts of all actors involved affect the appearance and structure of the resulting work. So these two elements, the distinction between the play as script and the play as performance, and the fact that they see, from dramaturgical perspective, you see the performance as a result of collaborative work. 2 minutes. Oof. They prevent an automatic transposition of the intention of the play as written by its author to the intention of the play as performed by a specific group of people at a specific time. So in theatre, in fact, it is true that at every new performance, the play is critically revisited and evaluated for the contribution it makes to the present-day concerns and issues. So it's seen as a value that we update a performance to present-day issues. So rather than stressing what is lost, for this also could help us to think differently about change in media art conservation. So rather than to stress what is lost, we stress what is gained in adapting scripts to the ever-changing ways in which we see and read the world. And I think that this perspective does more justice to the actual practice of time-based media conservation and exhibition. For instance, this is a work made in the Netherlands in 1979. And in 2003, the Netherlands Media Art Institute wanted to do a re-execution of this work. And together with the artist, they came up with this presentation, where the monitors were replaced by flat-screen televisions. And from a conservator's perspective, this is really quite daring, So Vivian van Saasen describes this process of reinstallation and says, well, it's in a way anachronistic. But I would say, well, if you look at it from a dramaturgical perspective, there's no problem at all. The artist himself, who was involved, liked that technological update, the present-day feel of the work. The audience did not notice at all the anachronistic approach. And moreover, this does not preclude another type of performance that that deliberately emphasizes the historical context in which a work emerged. So you can have the Sleeping Beauty Ballet in the classical 19th century version, or you can have Mats Ek's reinterpretation where the heroine of the story is a heroin addict. So you can always choose which version you want to execute. Well, so with Van Warmerdam, I think if we look at it from this perspective, there also are not really puzzles, because the artist can maintain the sculptural quality that she finds important. She just uses these big screens that are situated in space. As I said, the phenomenological qualities are also maintained. Let's see. Yeah, the audience did not notice it, nor did the critical reviewers. So, nobody commented on the absence of the projectors. So how essential are they then in the end? And from a conservation point of view, you could say that here the digital projection equipment did not belong to the work-defining properties. So, and the final comment, I don't have time to show you my clip, but the final comment is that I think also that we can distribute the responsibility for documenting all these versions and appearances of the work beyond the institution of the archive, because archives do not have the time nor the resources to do it. But theater also lives on without having, you know, extensive documentation of every minute performance. I mean, we do have institutions for that, but we also have critical reviews. We have theater historians who write about it. And we have general audience members. And here's the slide, and I will end on that, that relates to Stephanie's talk. This is a net artwork, Mouchette, by an artist who often works with virtual identities, and she created a 13-year-old girl named Mouchette. And it was in net art circles a very popular website. And what she did is she created an aboutmouchette.org page where she collects all sorts of documentation on the work that appears online, whether institutional or done by amateurs and fans. So this is exactly an example of how around an artwork you can build documentation that is entirely taken off the web. So I think the future is in participatory conservation. Thank you very much.